Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You've tuned in to another episode of The Incomplete Skeptic. The Incomplete Skeptic believes that everyone has a voice that can impact our world. Here, let's unplug marginalized mindsets from self-imposed prisons. Our primary purpose is opening minds and hearts in balance to help make our lives just a little bit happier. Today's guest has done this for me. I've listened to her story and it made me happier to be alive. And I had some synchronicities come up and I didn't want to invite my guest, Rosemary Thornton, because I thought, she's just going to shoot me down, you know, and, that self-sabotage stuff. And then I went online, folks, and I don't know if you believe in synchronicities, but there was somebody who was having a birthday, last name of Thornton. And it was right after I pretty much wrote off inviting this guest, you know, and I had heard her on George Norrie's show, Coast to Coast. And I was intrigued by it in so many ways. It aligned with like the spiritual messages that I've gotten through a lifetime, at least for the last 31 years or so. And even before, and the lessons that came up in my life over this long period of time, Rosemary nailed the meaning of the spiritual experiences. In other words, the spiritual awareness, you know, and sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, we have miracles happen in our lives. They happen both ways. You know, mine came over both quickly and slowly, but this is a really long introduction. She's experienced what is classically called an NDE, near-death experience. I don't think we ever die necessarily, but, you know, what their words, we do what we can with them. And she is the author of Remembering the Light, How Dying Saved My Life, Rosemary Thornton. Her website is www.temporarydeath.com. Her voice, I think, from what I've read from the online comments, have helped many people in this life. Her story has touched my desire to be more grateful. In fact, I woke up this morning more grateful because of having listened to it. And this might sound like an odd analogy, but it's one of my favorite lines in a movie on Titanic when Jack says, "Make every day count." Well, let's do that. I want to welcome you, Rosemary Thornton, for coming on the show, The Incomplete Skeptic.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Are you okay with that really long introduction?
That's fine. I've actually written 10 books. The first 9 were on architectural history and ancillary topics. So yeah, my 10th book is Remembering the Light. And one of the reasons I do these podcasts, and I've done quite a few, is I learn a lot. I learn a lot from other people, and I'm just delighted to hear you say that your hearing my story was a blessing to your life. And that email you sent me after you heard me on Coast to Coast was pretty interesting. I got so many emails. I got hundreds of emails, actually, which is fun. It's fun to read them. But you had talked about, I think you said, actually said, I felt moved in the spirit to refer to your work as a ministry. And that helped me a lot because I have struggled. I'm actually a very private person. I had some kind of fun success with my books on architectural history, and I made it to some nice shows like History Detectives and CBS Sunday Morning and things like that. So I had a good run and I had a lot of fun, but boy, there's a big difference between writing about architectural history and writing about something as intensely personal as my experience. Because as you know, if you heard me on Coast to Coast, this started with my husband's suicide and then my complete emotional mental breakdown, psychotic break, and you know, big messy thing. And boy, oh boy, one of the first talks I gave, this was right before COVID started, I gave a public talk and a woman stood up and she said, I just want to thank you for making yourself so vulnerable. And I had never thought of this before as vulnerability, but now that I've written that book, oh my goodness, this is making, I'd rather walk down Main Street without any clothes on, I think, than what I've just done to myself by putting that book out there. So yeah, it's a big deal. And framing it as being a ministry is very helpful. And I do get a lot of emails from people who say, you know, they had a loved one that ended their life, and that they understand things better now. So that's, you know, that's the reason really I did this. And so people are so funny. They go, I've had a few people say, oh, did you do this for the money? I'm like, apparently you don't know writers very well. And the other thing is, I died as a result of multiple medical mistakes. Four different medical professionals made significant errors in two hospitals. And if I was in this for the money, I would have sued somebody. And, you know, I can't say the thought didn't cross my mind, but I realized this was a mistake. People did their best. This was not malicious. They just, they're human beings, and they made a series of mistakes. So, yeah, let me get that question out of the way for any listeners. I'm not in this for the money. Sorry, it cracks me up to think of it like that. Me writing this book took 3 years, you know. I hate to average out my wages on this deal, but, you know, if the book does really well, I might make it to $1.60 an hour.
Said as a true writer.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, the synchronicities between your stories, they just keep lining up for me. And I don't want to make this interview about me. I want it to be about you and your story and your ministry, you know. I think about walking down the street naked, I have a metaphor that I use frequently, okay, is that I would rather leave the house naked than leave without wearing my prayers, you know, because I'd get in less trouble that way, you know. and there you go, using that example, that metaphor, it's like, wow. Yeah, I mean, it's just, they just continue to go on. We could spend the whole hour probably talking about this sort of thing, but it tells me that I'm in the right place in the right time. So I'm really glad that, you know, the Holy Spirit is using these opportunities for us to, you know, promote what the angels are saying, I guess. I don't know how else to say it. I'm going by your story and how, you know, you heard them and their music and their song and the like. But okay, I'm going to shut up now so you can continue with your story.
Well, there's a quote somewhere. I don't remember where I read it now, but it said, coincidences are miracles where God chooses to remain anonymous. And I just love that. You know, we don't give enough credit to, you know, that there is a oneness. I mean, look at the word universe. You ever think about that word? It means literally one song. Mm-hmm. There is a oneness to our existence. And an interconnectedness. And one thing I realized, I mean, after my husband, he ended his life at our home, and I'm a sensitive soul, a writer. I've been a writer for, gosh, I guess 35 years, long time. Very sensitive, very, I hope, empathic. I feel it. And I was extremely, talk about a range of emotions. But one of the things I felt was extreme anger. There was no warning. There was no signs. There was no history of poor mental health. He didn't seem to suffer from depression. He was a pretty cheery guy. He was what I called a bon vivant. He seemed to really enjoy life. So this came out of the blue, and it really messed me up in so many ways. But it took me a long time just to get over the anger and the rage I felt. And then after my temporary death experience, and I am a wordsmith, I guess. I don't like the word near-death experience to describe this. Near-death experience is if you're on an airplane and things go really badly and it looks like you're plunging to earth, and then the last minute the pilot pulls it out and everything's going to be okay. That's near death. When your heart stops and you have no vital signs for more than 10 minutes, that's not near death. That's going there and coming back. As my buddy Dale says, I got evicted from heaven. So words matter. Hmm. But anyway, I realized I if I was really angry at my husband, and I was, I've also read, and I think this is true, you can only love God as much as the person you like the least. And I thought, wow, that's very telling. So I that was really one. There's so many blessings that came as a result of this temporary death experience. And the title, you know, Remembering the Light, How Dying Saved My Life, that's not just a cute title. It's the truth. It was in glimpsing heaven and kind of being given a shake that I got to wake up again. And I have likened it in my book. Writing the book was a blessing for me. I don't know. It's fairly new on the market. Don't know how many it will sell, but it helped me organize my thoughts. Writing really is the highest form of thought discipline. Often I do listen to podcasts, and I can tell who's a writer and or who's written a book and who is not. I remember an interview with Steve Martin one time. He talked about his wife, Victoria Tennant. And what he said about her was she spoke in full paragraphs. And I love that. And what he was saying is she did not hem and haw and start down the path of one sentence and back up and change it and go to a new sentence. And that's what writing does. It helps you organize your thoughts. So even if the only reason I wrote the book was to sell 17 copies, which I have sold a few more than 17, it certainly was a great opportunity for me to organize my thoughts. And, you know, I got another email from somebody just today. It was such a blessing for me. She said she had read my book and she wanted to just tell me thank you. And she said, I savored every word, every bite, every sentence. She said it was almost like cheesecake. It was so filling. She said, I wanted to stop, but I felt like I also had to finish it. But one of the things she said was, I could tell from reading it that it was also a thank you note to all the people that had helped you. I thought, well, that's true. That was one of the very things I thought about as I wrote it. It's a way to publicly thank the people that helped me survive this. Because early on, after my husband's suicide, I knew I would not survive it. It was very, very clear to me that I would be dead in 2 to 3 years, maybe less. I just knew I wasn't going to survive it. Actually, I had a friend sit me down with a financial planner, and you know, she was very perky and very happy. And at that point in my life, after my husband ended his life, I lost everything. We had a nice life. We had a good life. We had a beautiful home. And I couldn't go back to the house again after he did this. And so I lost everything. I even lived out of my car for a brief time. It was very comfortable there. You know, it was a nice car. It was a Camry. And everything shifted and everything changed. Anyway, so I had a financial advisor sit down with me and say, where do you see yourself in 2 years? And without missing a beat, I said, I'll be dead. I said, I'm not going to survive this. And I just knew that nobody can go through this much pain and agony and expect to come out alive. So it's very clear to me. And every night I had three prayers. I had been a pretty devout person, but every night after his death, I had three very simple prayers. One was heal me or let me die. Do not leave me in this hellish limbo. And two was, when I die, spare me the life review. And number three was, I can't handle any more decisions. I had serious decision fatigue because after his death, there were many, many, many big decisions to be made. And I suppose we had kind of a traditional marriage. He was a very, very, very type A controlling individual. But I mean, he was successful. That's what made him who he was. That's what made me love him. He was very much a take charge kind of guy. So he'd taken charge of a lot of stuff. He'd taken charge of all the financial matters in our life and so many other things. And then after his death, I realized I didn't know passwords to his accounts. I didn't know anything. So there were a lot of big decisions to be made. There were some legal matters that needed immediate attention. So those were my three prayers. And the no life review thing is really important because after his death, I was not present when he ended his life, but I saw him afterwards. And I'm a very visual person, which is how I got drawn into architectural history. I have a really good memory for images. And after this, I had recurring nightmares pretty much every night, not every single night, but boy, I sure had those nightmares a lot of nights where I saw him. You know, it doesn't take a lot to imagine what things look like when a man uses a gun to end his life. And I had these recurring nightmares. And so I pretty much lived through his death every night for months. So when I asked for no life review, I knew what this looked like the first time around. I did not want to see it a second time. I did not want to see myself collapsing. I didn't want to see my friends going away, my so-called friends, by the way. You know, what's interesting is after his suicide, the so-called friends disappeared into the ether and the real friends appeared out of nowhere. And they were the people who, for the most part, actually right now, I think pretty much all of them, were the people who struggled to pay their electric bill. They were the people trying to keep body and soul together. And yet they gave me their love, their time. They gave me their energy. I used to tell people, I had a background in automotive technology, and I used to tell people, stop trying to help me. I'm beyond economical repair, which is a term for a car that's not worth fixing, called a BER. I thought, that's me, beyond economical repair. And one of the great blessings of these people in my life was, even though I was saying I was beyond economical repair, these people saw something in me worth saving. And that's a Christly gift. There's a painting Van Gogh has done or did called The Good Samaritan. Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
I discovered it at a church service in Champaign, Illinois. I used to travel around a lot, pretty much, I wouldn't call it traveling, but running, trying to find relief from the constant pain. And somebody in a church service showed me this, and they said, look how much energy it takes to get the wounded traveler up on the donkey or the horse. versus donkey. And I never thought about it. And it really became so clear to me. I mean, that was kind of a pivotal point in my own growth out of this horror, was that in that scene, it's a lot harder to be the person that becomes completely dependent on others, who find themselves in a ditch. I don't know if you remember the story, but the wounded traveler should not have been traveling on that road. He knew better. It was a road frequented by thieves and brigands and bad people, but he ended up in a ditch, and the Good Samaritan comes along and saves him. And I realized that being the person that has to be saved is a lot harder than being the person that does the saving, because you want to talk about humiliating. Oh my gosh. To go from being this self-accomplished, self-acclaimed author with expert in, you know, being on television and having some prestige in the world, to being a person that has to have somebody help her eat. I lost the ability to eat. I lost the ability to, I lived on this liquid, whatever, it's nutritional things for a while. I lost a tremendous amount of weight. I fell apart, just fell apart. I mean, I could write a book on that, and that's not the point of the story. Then 29 months out, I had been experiencing some very odd symptoms. And I went to a gynecologist. I'm not a fan of doctors. I've spent my life relying on spiritual healing, and I mean, really leaning on it. So I had never had a surgery, never been to, I think I went to a doctor when I broke something, and I went to a doctor when I had poison ivy so bad I couldn't open my eyes. But I was not, I always believed that God would take care of me. Which is part of what the suicide did to me, was I realized, can I trust God? I prayed for my husband every day. Could I really trust God with anything ever again? So, but anyway, I had all these symptoms and I didn't feel good. And I went to a doctor and they said, you've got stage 2 cervical cancer. And I went to another doctor and an oncologist at this point. And he was very definitive. And he said, yep, it's spread to a point where I can see the flesh is distorted. And there were tests done, and it was not good news. And then they did a biopsy to determine how far the cancer had spread, to figure out, you know, how do we go at this? Where is it? What's happening? And it was after that biopsy that they I woke up after the surgery. It's 30-minute surgery, and it took them 3 hours to wake me up. Pharmaceuticals are not my friend. And I woke up, and I told the RN who was attending me, I said, I'm bleeding profusely. She said, oh, honey, once you get home, lie down, you'll feel just fine. So 3 times in total, I told her something is gone wrong. And 3 times she said, just go home and lie down, you'll feel better. And I was not accustomed to the ways of the medical world. I should not have accepted that. I should have said, wait, Missy, something gone bad or wrong here. Anyway, I went home as told, and once home, I realized it was getting worse. Standing in my shower, because I have white carpet all through my house. And you know, when you're dying, the most important thing is make sure you don't mess up the carpet. So I was very concerned about my beautiful carpet. Really was nice carpet. So I went and stood in the shower for a while I figured out what to do. And I was bleeding profusely and it was bad. And I leaned against the wall in the shower, just watching my life's blood run right down the center drain in the shower and thinking the bleeding to death won't take long. And I remember thinking, I think it's 1 Corinthians 10:13, God will show you a way out. And I thought, you know what? I've been praying every night. God, heal me or let me go. I thought, this is it. God's answered my prayers. Way out. I had struggled mightily with my own suicidal ideations and temptations. And I thought, this is my way. Thank you, God. I got a path out of here. My children won't have to live with the stigma of suicide. And people will say, well, look, she just went to the doctor. She was trying to save herself. So I'm thinking these thoughts. And I had had 2 friends that brought me home from the hospital after this biopsy. And I thought, you know, is that really fair? To just sit down on the floor. I knew once I sat down on that tile floor, it'd be no getting up. I thought, is that really fair to have them come in here in a few minutes and discover my body splayed on the floor, bled to death? And I thought, no, these 2 people are 2 of the people that invested an awful lot of energy in keeping me alive. So I left the shower and went out there and said, call an ambulance, I'm bleeding to death. And they did, and was taken to a little ER, not attached to a hospital, a little standalone ER, and they made some more mistakes. And at that ER, one of the things that happened was I was getting a little weird in the head. You know, it turns out when you bleed to death, you don't do your best thinking. The brain uses some significant amount of energy. I forget what it is, but it uses a lot. So when you're losing blood, the brain's like, oh, what's happening? It's not good. So I was on that gurney now with this another RN holding my hand. And I said, promise me you're not going to let me die. And her precise response, her word for word response was, oh, honey, we're not going to let you die. We have many solutions for this. And it wasn't, these weren't just words. She was very clear. She was very confident that this was going to have a good ending. This wasn't going to go bad. So the next thing they did is they gave me a shot of Dilaudid, which is a morphine derivative, and that was boo-boo, because now I'm already down quite a bit of blood. And then they left me there, and my friend had accompanied me to the hospital. He followed behind in the ambulance, and he was there. And at one point, he looks up, and my blood pressure's at 32 over 25, and he realizes, you know, I'm on my way out, and he was like, oh, so this isn't good. And then, meanwhile, I'm having the time of my life. He said, right about the time my blood pressure went that low, he said, your eyes popped open. I had been unconscious at this point. And he said, your eyes popped open and you reached up to heaven. And he actually said, you tried to sit up on that gurney, but you were not able to sit up. So you put your shoulders up as high as you could and you reached up and you talked to somebody that only you could see. And he said, and then after that, you flop back down on the gurney. And that's when, you know, I suspect that that's when my soul left my body, frankly, is when I did that reaching up. You know, I've heard many stories about people in the dying process that they get this last burst of energy right before they go. And I suspect that's what happened to me. It was my last burst on my way out. But
it's terminal lucidity is what they're starting to call that. And it's been happening forever, but now they actually have a term for it.
Terminal lucidity.
Mm-hmm. Because
kind of
I was researching
it as terminal in front of it.
Well, yeah, it's just that when scientists or doctors are looking at the brain now, and I only found this out because I was researching your story and things like this, and they're seeing that there's like the brain suddenly charges up right at the point of death, and they call it terminal lucidity. And somebody will have like Alzheimer's or something, in a coma, whatever, and they will just start talking, have a clear conversation, and then poof, they're out of here, you know? And so there's a lot more to the brain than what the brain tells us there is, you know, there's the spirit and the mind. So anyway, didn't mean to interrupt, but I thought I'd pop that in there. And popping stuff out, I'll never look at Tulsa the same way again. And I'm waiting for you to describe that part. By the way, I was making breakfast this morning. I was looking at the toaster. I said, oh, I know she's going to say this. So, but I won't rip you off for it.
Well, it's true. I have looked, again, part of the benefit of spending 3 years writing something is you try to find just the right word. You know, Mark Twain once said, the difference between the right word and almost the right word is the difference between a lightning bolt and a lightning bug. He was right. So I had been in a deep dreamless state at the time of my death. And I woke up literally being catapulted out of my body. And I have often used the phrase like toast out of a toaster. This was not some gentle emergence, you know, some gentle, here we go. This was a kaboing, you know, it's very dramatic. But it was like right to the cusp of being jarring, but it was not jarring. And what's so fun, I knew exactly what was happening. And the first words out of my new mouth or my mouth in this new experience were, my heart has stopped. And I thought, how do I know that? And I don't know how I know that, but I know that's right. Isn't that something? And then my next thought was, I'm dying. And then I thought, actually, you know, being the good grammarian, I thought, you're not dying, you're dead. Because when you're going on to your reward, the most important thing is correcting your tense. And the thing is, I was talking to myself and I could hear, yeah, I've lived alone for years. I could hear my own voice and I sound just like I sound now. And after I said that, you're not dying, you're dead, I thought it was pretty darn funny. And I laughed out loud and I heard myself giggle. And I thought, okay, I don't have breath sounds. I don't think I have vocal cords. Do I have ears? And I thought, but I'm the same person I was back there. Nothing's changed. And then I realized everything I am had made this transition down to my goofball sense of humor, down to my crazy, stupid sense of humor. It had all come with me. And the memories, and I did not have a life review. I mean, I had a memory of what had happened, that the ambulance had come and they couldn't get it up the 10 stairs to my front door and on, but I didn't have a life review. And I mean, I didn't think about that at the time. I thought about it later. But I thought, how cool is that? That My laughter is still with me, and not only my laughter, but my bizarre sense of humor. And all my life as a reader and a writer, I thought of myself as something of a smart cookie. And yet I realized, one, this experience I was in now was so much like waking up from an intense dream to the reality. And all the et ceteras of the horrors of my husband's suicide would fill many books. But in short, it really felt like a loving parent had heard me crying out in the night from a terrible nightmare and had literally shaken me awake and said, it's over. That was just, it was bad and it was ugly, but it's over and you're okay. You're really okay. I mean, that's the best analogy I can come up with. And yet I almost hesitate to say that sometimes because there's lots of people who have suffered horrific traumas. I know more than one woman who has buried not one, but two or three children. And to tell them that this is a dream, I think is unfair. But when we're past it and we look back on it, it's a very different feeling. But one of the, and again, I felt like my whole life with this, you know, smart brain, I thought like I'd been living at 60 amps and now I got moved up to 100,000 amps. And time was not this, okay, we have the past, we have it present, and we have it future. Time was everything. Time was everything and time was nothing. Time was eternal. And I know that's hard for us to understand when our time construct is so intensely linear. Not only linear, but it only moves in one direction at one speed. So I'm not 100% sure of the sequence of the events, but it felt like on one hand, there were seven things happening at once, and yet I could absorb them all. But one of the early things that happened was I felt this massive spiritual being accompany me, and I'm floating away. I'm having the time of my life. And one of the things that happened, and this is not a typical NDE. My whole life, I'd been fascinated by reading NDE accounts ever since Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, came out. I think it was 76 or 78. I read that little trade paperback so many times I wore it out. And then Danyon Brinkley, Betty Eady, I read all those books over and over again. I'm fascinated by them. And I thought, you know, this isn't like the things I've been reading about. My NDE seems a little different, but that was okay. But I was floating away in blackness. I could not see my body. And again, I consider that God's mercy. My friend who had accompanied me got shooed out when they found out that I had died. So he was out in the waiting area, or actually he was out in the hallway outside the door. And he said three or four times the door to my little room opened and the staff emerged carrying armfuls of linen soaked in blood. And what had happened in the hospital is they had packed me with gauze. They called them 4x4s. They packed me with gauze and that had not stopped the bleeding. It had just stopped the mess. So I had continued to bleed in that little ER. So when they pulled that gauze out, they saw I had bled out. So, but one of the things was that my, when I popped out of that body, like toast out of a toaster, it really felt like I sensed that there was a silvery, sinewy cord from the crown of my head to the bottom of my feet. And it was as though somebody had pulled back on that like an archer's bow and let loose. And when it hit my back, it's when I felt like I popped out. It was really dramatic. So anyway, one of the earlier events that happened was I realized I was accompanied by a massive spiritual being. And I mean massive. And he was slightly to my left. Well, to my left, slightly behind me, and much taller than me. And I'm like, oh man, I'm floating away from my body. I got out of there peaceful and easy. I mean, not a bad death. Took 6 hours to bleed out, but hey, what the heck? And now I have somebody with me. And so I turned my head slightly to the left and looked behind me, interested in the fact that I have a left shoulder and I have a head. And I'm expecting to see this being, even though I'm in this total blackness. And I said, truly with a lilt in my voice, I said, and who are you? And the spiritual being said, you are the image and likeness. I'm the original. I was like, whoa, that's first Genesis 26 and 27. I had spent a lifetime trying to understand what it meant to be the image and likeness of God. I had never in my life heard that term, the original. I had never thought in context. I have read so many Bible commentaries and exegesis and all these other things, and I had never seen that phrase of the original. And it was more than words. It literally was an infusion of knowledge. If such a thing could be said, it felt like every cell in my being understood what that meant now. And I do very clearly remember thinking, you know what, that would have been good to know back there, but hey, it's knowledge is good. I'm sure it'll be a blessing. And the other Bible verse that came to me was the peace that passeth all understanding. And Paul said that. And I realized, I know a lot of people talk about the love in heaven. For me, it was the peace. the piece was the big deal. The piece was a perfect piece. It was like I was almost drowning in peace, and drowning's the wrong word, but completely ensconced in peace. It was everywhere. It was every. I was like at the center point of infinite peace. It was just the most perfect piece. I realized this is what Paul was talking about. You can't understand this unless you experience it. So, and the fact that I could remember all these Bible verses, and I could, again, it was like I was having memories come from so many directions in so many ways. But this went on and on for some time. And one of the things that happened that was, again, just such a blessing. Now I was in, still floating further and further away from my body and floating very gently. I felt the presence of other angels or spiritual beings. And I said to one of them, I have been here before, like within this conscious experience, I have been in this blackness, in this very place, floating away, feeling the love of God, the peace of God, and floating away. And the angel said, remember that story your mom told you when you were a baby, that you were given up for dead as an infant. And the angel said, you weren't close to death. You actually crossed over and you got sent back because you have things to do. And I thought, you know, that explains my whole life. I had spent 58 years wondering why I was an oddball, why I didn't fit in anywhere with anybody, where I could hear the angels talk as easily as I hear people talk. And I never understood why I was so different. And now I understand, and also why I had read every NDE book I could get my hands on. I mean, I found them just captivating. So I was like, you know, again, that would have been good to know when I was on Earth, but okay. And the other thing that struck me, those 58 years on Earth, that it seemed so weighty and so important. It's like coming home to one of those, coming home from a party that you maybe spent 30 minutes because you didn't know anybody and kind of just hid in the bathroom the whole time and you weren't having any fun. And you're thinking, I have to wait till 30 minutes when I can leave. And then when you get home, you're like, ah, it's no big deal. Why do you think it was such a big deal? And that's how I felt about my 58 years on Earth. I really, truly, honestly felt like I got early release for good behavior. I was so glad. For so many years of my life, I have kept a daily gratitude list where I list the things for which I am grateful. And floating away from my body, I kept thinking, I'm so grateful that it's over. And being a writer who tends to ruminate and overthink every single thing, I also thought, I just kind of wondered how it would end. And it's over. It's over. What a big deal. I always wondered what would take me out. It turned out to be a medical mistake from somebody who never goes to the doctor. That was great. I did find a certain irony in that. And then I don't remember the transition, but at one point I'm floating in this blackness and not even thinking what's next. I'm not even thinking. I'm thinking, oh, this floating's great. I did actually say to myself, I like floating. Floating is fun. This is great. And when I came back from this and I wrote all this down, I'm like, you're a writer. You know all the big words. Well, you sound like a kid. I like floating. Floating is fun. This is great. And that's one of the ways I know I had no intention of coming back, because I would have been much more prosaic, far more loquacious, used much bigger words. I like floating, seriously. So I don't remember the transition, but at some point I was no longer floating, but I was standing in a white room. And truly, it feels like somebody took my batteries out. I do not remember how I transitioned from floating to being on my own feet in a white room. And the room, I guess, maybe 15 feet wide, maybe 20. And I was at one end of it, I guess. I was in the room and I saw a white door in front of me in a wall. And I thought to myself, I don't know if I have feet. I don't know if I have legs, but I know what that door means. That door is where I cross the Rubicon. That door is the point of no return. There's no coming back from that. And I thought, it pretty much said, everybody out of my way, I'm doing the door. I just wanted to get this show on the road. And as I moved through this room, there was a white mist or a fog or vapor. And the thing was, this mist or vapor wasn't just falling as one might experience in a traditional fog. These little droplets were moving, swirling, dancing. And this room was bright, bright, bright white, luminescent, iridescent, perfect white. And I asked the angel that accompanied me, I said, I feel like I should be able to focus on an individual droplet, but I can't. And the angel that was with me said, your eyes have not acclimated to this new environment yet. You know, just telling you this, I was thinking, I had eyes, you know? The angel wouldn't have said your new vision apparatus hasn't acclimated. She said your eyes. have not acclimated to this new environment, but it's light. They're particles of light that is swirling around you and dancing around you. And what was explained to me very clearly, and I heard you say just a moment ago, you don't leave the house without being dressed in prayer. It was like a spiritual car wash where all the muck of the earth was washed away. And it was made very clear to me that we do not go to heaven while we still have the impressions of the world on us, and that some people get so tangled up in a disease or mental illness or anything that they think it's part of their spiritual identity and they forget. No, that's not part of your spiritual identity. The purpose of the white room is to remove that, to take that away. And as a friend said, and I love this, leave your muddy boots at the door. How can we go into heaven when we believe we've had a limb amputated or we have a disease that has left us disfigured or whatever the case may be? And so I was told this white room was for cleansing the muck of the earth. I mean, that's what was told to me. And as I got to the door, I'm sorry to say I don't remember exactly the precise timing. Again, timing is an interesting word. What is time? What is time? But how many times the sun goes around the earth? How many times the earth goes around the sun? It's a very earthly construct. So I don't know the timing, but I went up to that door and I approached the door and I put my right hand up to push through it. Still a little, not annoyed, but just a little wondering, why is that door closed? Most of the stories I had read were porters or doorways, and it wasn't closed. And what was told to me, well, again, I'm not sure the sequence of events, but I was prepared to push through that door because I really wanted to go. But I did pause at the door. I remember this very clearly. I paused at the door and I said simply, is this the divine will for my life? Because the only way I can describe it is when you are in that place, all you want to do is glorify God and do God's will. I mean, that was the most important thing. And the answer was no, this is not the divine will for your life. And again, it came with an infusion of knowing. And the answer was, it's not. But whatever you decide, if you decide to go forward or you decide to go back to earth, you go with all of God's mercy and grace and blessings and love and care. I thought, I will take that deal. And I was getting ready to go through the door. And I had a vision of that nurse who had been so kind to me in that final ER. And she had said to me, she's the one who said to me, oh, honey, we're not going to let you die. We have many solutions for this. And in this vision, and people have asked me if this was concurrent. It was not. I believe this to have been a potential future vision. I saw her in a hospital supply room surrounded by the linens and all the stuff you have in the hospital. She was sitting on a little metal stool in the middle of the room with her head in her hands and sobbing uncontrollably. And she said through tears, I promised this woman I wasn't going to let her die. And I lost her. And I remember looking at the angel and saying, seriously, please don't ask me to go back. You know, I thought, well, she's an RN. She looked to be about my age. I mean, she's been doing this a while. She's lost patience. Surely she knows how to deal with this. And then I wasn't just, and this vision is the wrong word. It was like I had been invited to be a quiet participant in her own experience. It's very intense. And then I didn't just see her. I felt the pain, the agonal pain, the emotional pain of having broken a promise, even though she gave it her best energies, I'm sure, and all the rest of it. And I realized when I felt that pain, I recognized the depths of that emotional pain. And I thought, actually what I thought was, if I can spare one person on this earth that much suffering, I have to go back. And it was difficult, but it wasn't. And again, about that timing issue, one of the things that was made very clear to me was if I agreed to go back, I'd be restored to wholeness. And the thing was, it wasn't that you'll be healed, but that I would be restored to wholeness. It was almost like just an impression. I can't say they were words. It was just a knowing. So after seeing that nurse's pain, I put my right hand down by my side and I said, it'll ruin this nurse's day if I die. And that seems like a goofy thing to say, but in a millisecond, I was back on that gurney. There was no backwards push. It was just a millisecond. And again, what, I don't know, they take my batteries out again? I don't know. But and the thing was, that same nurse, I believe it was the same nurse, she was right in my face when I opened my eyes and she said, what is your name? I said, Rosemary. She said, what year is it? I said, 2018. And she said, where are you? And I said, a crummy excuse for an ER, which I was back. But after 10, it had been 10 minutes. that I had not had a heartbeat, more than 10 minutes, actually. And the cool thing about this, when somebody dies of bleeding to death, you cannot even do CPR because you just push more blood out. Because what CPR is, heart compressions. So my brain had no oxygen for more than 10 minutes. And theoretically, after 5 to 6 minutes, the amount of the brain damage is catastrophic. So when she asked me, I told this story to a retired anesthesiologist. And when I got to the part about, you know, where are you? And I said, a crummy excuse. He became very emotional and he sobbed. And I said, are you okay? And he said, I don't think you can imagine the relief that nurse felt in knowing that they'd done the right thing in bringing you back. Because it's iffy. You can get somebody back. You can get their heart going. What are you bringing back? So that was a pretty big deal. And then they threw me in that little ER. They threw me on another gurney pretty darn quick. And I was sent to a trauma center. And I was there in a hospital for 4 days. And, you know, they came to discharge me on day 4 at that hospital. And I said, I really like this place. They bring you food every day. I just lie here like a bump on a log. And they keep bringing me food. And they come in and they say, how are you today, Rosemary? Can we get you some applesauce? Would you like some more cranberry juice to drink? I loved it. And the doctor, I just love this doctor. Once you're in a trauma center and you've actually died and they bring you back, and they're real nice to you. They pay really good attention to you. And that doctor, on day 4, he said, it's time for you to go home. Actually, they're going to discharge me to a convalescent center, basically a step down. Because he said, it's going to be a couple of weeks before you can take care of yourself. And since I lived alone, they thought, you know, that was it. And several friends were able to come to my home and care for me for a couple of weeks. But I said, I don't want to go home. It's really nice here. Y'all are real kind to me. And he said, your white blood, you know, I mean, my blood count was way low. But he said, your white blood cell count is still very low. That if you contract an opportunistic infection, it'll take you out. You know, nurse, staff, something. He said, there's nothing we can do to save you. He said, so we have, and I love this part. This part touched my heart. He said, we sat down this morning at a meeting and, you know, with other doctors to figure out what is the best care plan. I don't know what they call it. And he said, the risk of you becoming catastrophically ill from a compromised white blood cell count versus the risk of you bleeding out again, you need to go home. And you'll have people watching over you and taking care of you. And the other thing that happened, as soon as I was at that hospital, I mean, I was transported that night to a hospital. It was about 6 at night. The next morning, this doctor came to see me, same doctor. He came to see me. I guess he's called a hospitalist. The first thing he said to me was, one of the first things he said, last night, your heart stopped. He said, actually, what he said is, you had a heart attack and your heart stopped. And I said, not me. Nope, nope, nope. I ride my bike. I walk. I eat my green veggies. I'm very healthy. And he said, no, no, no. This was you. And he said, your blood work shows that you had a heart attack. Apparently, the enzymes get elevated. And he said, but your numbers are already coming back down this morning. So we know that it's not underlying heart disease. But he said, I said, how much blood did I lose? And he said, more than 40%. I said, well, I have an analytical mind. I want a number. And he said, after 40%, it doesn't matter because your heart will stop. So that was nice, actually, to have authentication and have proof that this wasn't just some interesting experience, but I died. And then the other thing, it took time, and I'm watching our time here. It took some time, but I found another oncologist. Turns out when you say you were healed in heaven, the oncologist who saw the cancer and diagnosed you with stage 2 is not very enthusiastic. In fact, when I went back to him, he said, now, look, you're supposed to start this chemo tutorial next week. I was like, well, you know, doc, I don't know that I've made a decision to do the chemo. I'm pretty sure that I was healed in heaven. And when you do that, what happens is they write on your chart that you're mentally ill. Mm-hmm. That's how that goes. Because they do this thing now that your chart goes online and you can go look at your chart online. And I saw that I had been adjudicated mentally ill because I thought it was healed in heaven. So I had to find another oncologist. And to his credit, he thought this was the right thing to do. In fact, I think what he said to me was, so you're going to decline a scientifically, empirically proven medical treatment to go with a faith cure. And I said, no, that's not what I'm doing here. I'm going with spiritual healthcare. And it didn't go well. And he told me in great detail how he would die. And he'd been with other cancer patients that had chosen this, and they died a terrible, wretched, ugly death. And he explained to me how I would die in great detail, what would happen to my body and how it would happen and when it would happen and on and on and on. And he said, and then you'll drown in your own fluids. He said, is that really how you want to go? So that blew me away. I was pretty shocked by that and upset. Larry Dawsey, you ever heard of his book? Be careful what you pray for.
The name sounds familiar. Yeah, I'm familiar with the concept. Be careful what you pray for. Yeah.
He was a cardiologist, and he found that people were being healed without medical help. And he's really kind of a pioneer in writing about spiritually based healing. So I had to find another oncologist, and it took a couple months for her to agree to do a second surgical biopsy, which is what she insisted had to be done to make sure that I was right. And, you know, you get into the world of oncology and doctors, they don't like hearing this healed in heaven stuff. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of tests done in the interim, and those tests were actually a real blessing, because at every test, I would have a meeting with the oncologist, and she'd say, I don't see anything. Hmm. She said, we can't be sure yet, but the PET scan came back clean. The MRI with contrast came back clean. Everything was coming back perfect. And then when they did the second surgical biopsy, again, it was 3 hours in surgery. But the reason was she took a lot of flesh from a lot of places. And then she had another doctor in the surgical suite with her checking all these samples, double checking her work. And then it was sent off to outside labs. And the bottom line is this oncologist, after my second surgical biopsy, she went out to my friend who was waiting outside for the report. She literally threw her arms around his neck and said, she's right. There's not one cell, not one cell. I mean, it's a big deal. I try not to get emotional. I've told this story so many times. But and then she actually woke me up while I was in recovery. And she said, you're right. There's nothing there. And what she said later was, your flesh is so pink and pretty and perfect. I can't believe you ever had cancer. Well, what she said was, outside of the medical test. And yet it had been advanced enough to be visible upon an exam. And plus, I had had those pretty ugly symptoms, including some, I don't want to get into detail, but it's pretty ugly symptoms. And they disappeared. They all disappeared. I'd had intermittent fevers and on and on and on. So that was all gone. And then after this happened, I also realized the grief was gone. And a lot of people say when they come back from death, they feel like they're 50% in that world and 50% in this world. I felt 95% in that world. And I talked to the angels a lot. A lot of people say, did you see your husband in heaven? I did not. I didn't see any loved ones. But after I was back from this, I felt the angels just all around me, all around me. I mean, like more real than the human beings that walked into the room. And so I talked to the angels in those first days in the hospital. I talked to him a lot. I asked him a million questions. That's not true. I probably asked him 50 questions, and he answered all of my questions beautifully. And I got peace. And the agony that had been my hour by hour life for 29 months was gone. So it wasn't just, the physical healing, of course, was very important. I don't diminish that at all. I'm so grateful. But I opened my Bible when I was back home, and it flopped open to the 23rd Psalm. And it's the one line in it, it just seemed like it'd been highlighted, literally lit up. It said, he restoreth my soul. And I realized that was the real healing. That's something that medicine can't touch. And that's what God had done for me. My soul had been restored. And I found when I got back from this, I'd also been healed of I had arthritis in my wrist. It was gone. I had a busted right knee, a busted left shoulder. It was fine. I'd had some high frequency hearing loss, too many years of rock and roll. And that was, I could hear people down the hallway. My hearing was so good. And my friend who's an IT said, he said, you got a reboot from the creator. And when I came back from this, I sold every single thing I owned and moved 1,000 miles due west, because all I wanted to do was be around beautiful things. And I have never regretted selling all my stuff. I had a lot of research materials from all these books and history and such. I donated the great majority of them to a local college, and then sold off everything. I was actually stand over like my couches and end tables and lights and everything, lawn furniture. I sold lawn furniture, but I would stand over every item and I'd say a little prayer, and I would say, God, this chair has been such a blessing in my life. It's brought me so much joy, but now it's time for somebody else to be blessed. So, and it all went to good homes. And then out in the Midwest, I just wanted to be around beauty. I wanted to watch corn grow. I'm in an acre that I'm in an area that has a lot of farm acreage, a lot of agricultural stuff. So they plant corn out here by the thousands of acres. And boy, when that corn starts popping up through the soil, it's a beautiful thing to see. So yeah, I just wanted to be around beauty. Nothing else mattered. And I forgave everybody everything. I mean, I realized that if I hated anybody, if I was even angry with anybody, I was letting some of that muck get into my newly minted soul. So it was a very, very dramatic change in my thoughts.
Yeah, I believe in forgiving everything too. And I think forgiving myself is always at the bottom of not being able to forgive someone else. And, you know, that's just my personal take on it. Now, I remember from your telling your story on a different show that you said your husband blamed you. And these, you know, are you willing to share the four words that you said that he texted to you? Or
well,
is it too personal?
I had that in one of my former iterations of my book, and I removed it because he's working out his own salvation now.
Yes, I loved that story too. I heard that. I was hoping you'd at least say that part of it.
I know the problem is, you know, with a time limit, there's so.
Oh no, I'm okay.
What do I
it's
share
up
today?
To you.
Oh yeah, I'm happy to share that.
Okay.
Yes, one of the things hit my table. One of the things that was so vexing, so painful, was he had been an agnostic and I had been a good Christian, and or so I told myself, and I thought if I was a good enough Christian, I could show him the way to heaven, I could show him the way to Christ, I could show him the way of the risen Savior. I really did. In fact, something I wrote in one of my little, I keep notebooks when I go to church services because I don't want to forget a thing, but something I had written 3 weeks before his death was, God, help me open his eyes, help me teach him who Jesus Christ is. And to realize that I had failed was devastating. And I became very, very guilt boy. I mean, every suicide survivor deals with guilt you can't imagine. Just can't imagine. You know, you end up reviewing every conversation you ever had with this individual and think, God, I was not very kind at times. How could I say that to him? So yeah, you end up just beating yourself up constantly. But yeah, one of the things that the angels told me after this, I felt like I had been appointed his spiritual guardian before my NDE. I felt that way, and I had failed. I had failed Wayne. I failed my husband, but I had also failed God. What do you do when you think you have failed, you know, the Almighty? And I just was so guilty. You know, in the first Genesis, it says the serpent beguiled Eve. And if you look up that word beguiled and guilt have the same root word. And I've since come to understand better that when we're being guilted, we're being beguiled. You know, that is a devilish tool. That is not God. God does not impose beguiling or guilt. And how fun that it sneaks into the camp disguised as, you know, selflessness, that you're trying to be a good Christian. So, yeah, that shredded me for a while, that I had failed God and that I was so guilty about the whole thing. And one of the things the angels told me, I said, where is he now? I need to know, where is my husband? And they said, he's with us. And I was so comforted by that, because half the time I wanted him to be suffering the pains of hell, and half the time I wanted him to be spared the pains, or I wanted him to be spared that. I wanted him to be in heaven. I mean, I was before my NDE, my TDE, I was so conflicted. I didn't know what I wanted. And then after this, what the angel said is, he's with us. And I said, I failed, you know? And they said, they addressed that. I don't even know if I posed it as a question, but they addressed it. And they said, we work out our own salvation. It was never your job to work out his salvation. Mm-hmm. And I asked some more questions about him. And they said, none of your business. And I was like, wow, coming from the spiritual beings that keep company with the Most High God, that seems a little brusque to me. But the answer was, you're not his spiritual guardian. You need to work out your path, and he's going to work out his path. But it is not up to you to work out his path. And to have appointed yourself in such a manner was nothing God ever said. It was nothing the angels ever told you. It was part of this guilt package And that was so liberating. And the other thing I said all the time, I thought he loved me. How could he do this? I thought he loved me. How could he do this? Oh, my goodness. And something the angel said was, it's actually a Bible quote from Deuteronomy. I think it's Deuteronomy 2:3. You've circled the mountain long enough, time to stop and go north. And when I said I thought he loved me, how could he do this? There's no way to get out of that rumination. It's the wrong question. And the angels told me, you're asking the wrong question. And they said, stop saying, how could he do this? I loved him so much. And say instead, I loved. And they said, when you love, you open yourself up to the river of light that flows from God, and it flows through you and purifies you and removes anything unlike God. And you don't have to have a human to attach love to. That's a trick, that you just love. And I didn't lose love when I lost my husband. And that was so liberating. And I wrote about this in my book. And even again, just writing it out helped me understand. But it was like I had shackled myself. You know, the Bible says, if I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. I had not only made my bed in hell, I had set up housekeeping. I was very comfortable in hell. It seemed like a good place for somebody whose husband killed themselves. It seemed like the best place for me to be was in hell and to stay there. And it was as though God said, you can't stay here. You know, this isn't where you're supposed to be. This isn't where you need to be. I have not imposed this sentence on you. This is not of God. And I realized I had spent so many, 29 months shackled. And then it was like looking down at your hands and realizing there are no shackles. The only shackles were self-imposed. And then in time, I realized that this wasn't my story, this whole ugliness that I repeated over and over and over and over again to everybody. Everybody who'd listen, my husband killed himself. I'm really struggling. I'm having a terrible time. And I realized that isn't my story. Why do I keep repeating it? Why do I keep rehearsing it? Why do I keep saying it? And it was just like, it was just, why would I do that? It was like telling a lie about somebody. Mm. Why would you do that? And then it wasn't more than a couple days later that I realized it's not even his story. You know, he's also a child of God. It's not even true about him. It was something dark that happened, but it's not really about who he is as God's child. And that enabled me to move the darkness and the lie off of him and just realize it's just darkness and lies and it's not true. And then the thing is, this happened three and a half years ago. And still every day, I feel like I'm growing out of that position. I mean, it was another catapult, I guess, but I'm still growing into a full understanding. And, you know, not a day of my life goes by that I don't think about what it means to be the image and likeness of the original. That has changed me. Not a day of my life goes by that I don't think about that multiple times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every now and then I'll pass. There's a popular juice drink right now, and it's one of the best selling names. And it says on the back of it, there's nothing as good as the original. And I see that I've left it on the counter so I can see it every day. There's nothing as good as the original. But there has not been one day in these many months that I have not thought about what it means to be the image and likeness of the original.
You know, I'm going to throw in a little bit of a perspective and maybe a little story. You know, I'm not a huge C.S. Lewis fan, but when I was going through The Dark Night of the Soul, one of the books that I read was a book of his, A Grief Observed. Very good book, very short book. And, you know, my Dark Night of the Soul lasted for 3.5 years, and the first 2.5, I wanted to die every day, all day. And I just begged God to just kill me, you know, and I didn't believe I could kill myself because it wasn't my life to take, because I had surrendered my life to God. It was none of my business. And but C.S. Lewis said, you know, the door to hell is opened only from the inside.
Oh, and wow. I'd forgotten that.
You know, right? Isn't that good information? And then there, somewhere along the line, somebody imparted wisdom, or is it an accident, or who knows, maybe God planted a word in my head. But somebody said that it's none of my business what other people think of me. And I thought, well, it's none of my business what I think of me either. My business is what God thinks of me. It's none of my business what I think of myself. Otherwise, I'm making it about me, you know. So that whole thing is a little bit like the door to hell being opened only from the inside. And, you know, you You probably don't know this about me, nor should you, but, you know, I've been in MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and have done a lot of work with other organizations, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, and have spoken at a lot of schools. And, but one day at church, after church, I was waiting for a prayer session, and I think that's what I was doing, but I was contemplating because I had to speak either that night or the next day or something. It was coming up soon. And I was trying to think, well, what can I do to give a better speech, you know? And I was just racking my brain to come up with something. And I always pray about things, you know, and I won't generally open my mouth unless I prayed first. And by the way, there's a lot of people praying for this interview, you know. And but then I heard that voice, you know, you've heard a voice too. And this voice, I've heard it before. And only one time was this voice really unhappy with me. This wasn't one of those times, but it was the same voice. And the voice said, you know, my victim was a child. Okay. I drove under the influence and I killed a child. And you know, the child's mother and I are now friends. She says she loves and forgives me. It took her decades to get there. And, you know, and as I was praying about it and contemplating on it, I heard that voice say, "What? You think you can do a better job with little Timmy than I can?" And I had to let go of that part of it where I was struggling to make right what I had done wrong and make it all about me. And, you know, a very wise woman told me after she had been in recovery for 40 years or something in codependency. I can't name the group because it's an anonymous thing. Her husband was an alcoholic and she was of the other discipline. And after she spoke about forgiving someone who drove under the influence and killed somebody, I waited about a half hour to be able to talk to her. And I said, well, you know, this is, I did too, you know, and my victim was Sherry and little Timmy. Sherry's a mother and Timmy's a baby. And she stopped me immediately. And she said, wait a second. Sherry's not your victim. Timmy is. Timmy's dead. You can't bring him back. He's your victim, but Sherry can be as happy as she makes up her mind to be. And you're not her God. And you can't play God in her life. You're not her problem and you're not her solution. It's like, oh, I had a hard time wrapping my brain around the idea that I'm not her problem and she's not my victim. And I only bring that comparison up because of the dynamic between your husband and yourself and his trying to make it all about you somehow. And no matter the path we've gone down, it's not how any of this works, is the unconditional love. And it, whatever happens in heaven or whatever you want to call it, wherever we go, is going to be about love. And there are so many things about your NDE or TDE story that aligned with my life in so many ways that every other story I've heard hadn't. And I felt so compelled. I mean, the darkness, you know, I've been in that darkness. One time my spirit left my body from grief and my heart stopped beating. My spirit left my body. And then I was kind of shocked. I'm looking down at my body, laying there lifeless. And I didn't even know that could happen. You know, but I decided to not be here. So I thought, nope, I'm not going out this way. And my body slammed back, my spirit body slammed back into my physical body and my heart started beating again. And I jumped up physically and I started walking back and forth. And, you know, I won't go into all that, but I just learned that life is a choice. We don't have to slit our wrists. We don't have to string it. We don't even have to shoot ourselves. All we got to do is really not want to be here and we're gone. It's a sacred contract. It's a decision, you know? And I know you've talked about sacred contracts. Okay, now I'm going to get done with this Timothy part. What's your take on sacred contracts?
I had a friend share with me, you know, I've met a lot of people now who've had near-death experiences or a temporary death. And I've learned so much from them. There's so many blessings that came as a result of this experience, but getting to be with these folks who've had these experiences, I've learned so much from them. But when I had this experience at age 58, I mean, I had been asking God every day to either heal me or let me die. And frankly, I just wanted to be dead. I didn't see how I could be healed. I mean, I felt I had known somebody years ago that her husband had killed himself. And she dragged through life for 30 years, and she hated every day of it. I didn't want that to be my path. But something a friend shared with me, and I thought it was brilliant. She said, you probably, when you, because I don't want to talk about reincarnation. I'm not crazy about that doctrine. But I do believe that we were somewhere before we came here. Anybody who's seen a little baby be born, they didn't start with some genetic connection. There's just too much energy there. So I believe that we came from somewhere and we go somewhere. But she said that when you were navigating this experience to come, wherever we come from, she said, sometimes when we have really hard lives, we give ourselves a few early exits that are options to take. And that really resonated with me, that apparently I had decided, man, I've ticked off a lot. You know, I was very briefly at 14, I was abandoned by my father. My mother didn't take it well. So at age 14, I kind of had to grow up in a big hurry. I knew what it was like to struggle. Let's leave it there. And then my first marriage ended after 24 years, not a good ending. And then this. So it just felt like an awful lot to deal with in one lifetime. Mm-hmm. So I do think that sometimes maybe we give ourselves an early out. I think, and that's truthfully what part of what helped me forgive my husband. And also forgive others who've done things. I mean, we're humans. Everybody makes mistakes. There's some not nice people in the world. And every now and then we cross paths with them. And I don't know if you remember Fiddler on the Roof, where Tevye says, he asked the rabbi, is there a blessing for the czar? And do you remember what the rabbi says?
Mm-mm.
May God bless the czar and keep him far away from us. I love that. So sometimes when I encounter these not nice people, I think, may God bless them and keep them far away from me. So
pray for that SOB.
That's right. So as to sacred contracts, realizing that these people, it's one of two things. Either they really don't know any better, or that they've agreed to be a nasty person on this earth so that they can teach the rest of us some really big lessons. And you know who Corrie Ten Boom is, right?
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you about a quote from hers, actually, but go for it. You're
I
on it already.
I love Corrie. I've read 43 books, and I think I've read all of them. Mm. I went through my Corrie Ten Boom phase. I love that. Mm-hmm. I love her writing. But she said, Christ can be a tough schoolmaster, but one learns the most when the classes are the hardest. Mm. And I mean, that's a woman who walked out of Ravensbrück after seeing her sister Betsy killed by a combination of a beating and conditions at the camp. And then she practiced that forgiveness. I don't know if you remember the story. She actually had one of the guards show up at one of the talks she gave about forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And she reached for that guard's hand to shake, or actually he reached for her hand to shake her hand and say, he said something to her like, you preach forgiveness. Can you forgive me? I was at one of the camps, and he didn't recognize her. And she said in her mind, she thought, no, I can't. Sorry. Mm. You know, but she literally begged God, if I'm going to be able to give these talks, to go around preaching the story of Jesus Christ, if I'm going to do this, God, you've got to give me the power to forgive him because I don't have it. And she said she felt something like a surge of energy or electricity go through her. And she was able to put her hand out. And when they connected, she realized it was genuine. She had found that place of peace to forgive that man. I love that story.
Mm. The woman that got me in MAD told a story when I was in early recovery from alcoholism. I was sober 90 days. And she said that she had forgiven the person that killed her son and gave him a hug in the courtroom and said, I love you and I forgive you for killing my son. And I think she might have helped save his life that day. She probably could have killed him with a few words. And I never thought I'd hear a mother say that, you know. And when she asked me to speak, because I told her what I had done, I said, no, I'm not speaking. I mean, why would any, all the people are going to just hate me or whatever. And through time, she became my spiritual advisor, and they call it a sponsor. And she used to tell me things about forgiveness, you know, and she would quote Corrie Ten Boom frequently. And I'm not going to ask you what you think of this, because you've already told me. But it's on my business card, the back of my business card. We forgive notwithstanding the temperature of our hearts, which is not an exact quote, but the exact quote is, forgiveness is an act of the will, and the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. And I respected this woman who got me in mad. Her name was Mary Jo Robinson. And I asked her, well, how could you do this? How could you forgive him? And she said, well, no one has a right to be an obstacle to a fellow human being getting well. If they want to get well, we got to let them. And she said, you know, we don't get ready to meet God as much as we meet God to get ready. And, you know, and we got to quit walking with the enemy, and the enemy is usually us, and we trap ourselves, you know, and you talked about that here. We have to free ourselves from that self-imposed prison. And I saw this piece of art where this, this fellow had, it was operating like a bicycle with his hands on the pedals of the bicycle. And then there's a chain going up from the wheel on that bicycle and then going over his head into the back. And then there's this huge wheel in the back, and it's got boots coming out of the spokes. As he's rotating this thing, it's polishing his hindsight, you know.
And oh, he thinks, geez.
You know, and it's a self butt kicking machine, you know. And he thinks it's the world doing it, but he's the one operating it, right?
Oh,
and I thought that was a really profound thing, you know. So I had to quit operating that machine, and I asked God for a lot of help. And you know, the dark night of the soul. I don't know if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like that's sort of what you've gone through, is a dark night of the soul. Have you ever given that much thought?
There was a book written by that very title. Mm-hmm. And I saw that book, gosh, I don't know, 18 years ago or so. And it's a haunting phrase. Mm-hmm. What came to me at the depths was that I felt like I was in the middle of the icy Atlantic on a moonless, dark night, and I couldn't even find a piece of driftwood to latch onto. Mm-hmm. And no matter how much I screamed, nobody was coming for me. Mm-hmm. And I did this thing. I mean, I like to think of myself as pretty self-disciplined. Like I said at the beginning, people told me, write a book, write a book, write a book. And I said, no, 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 no. And then I realized maybe this write a book thing is something I'm supposed to do. And boy, I can't tell you how resistant I was to that whole idea. But I think of myself as pretty self-disciplined. And yet, after this thing happened, I did this thing called, my daughter called it the pterodactyl scream, where I would start to cry. And sitting on my couch in my living room, you know, this is while I've got a house full of guests for the funeral, not guests, but, you know, the people come by to,
yes,
to be a comfort. And I would scream. I'd simply scream at the top of my lungs over and over and over. And if you want to clear out a house full of friends and relatives, you do some pterodactyl screams in your living room. People don't know how to manage that. And the woman who helped me through it, she lived near me. And every now and then I would say, go get somebody, get her, somebody get her. And she would come and she would sit on my couch beside me, and she would put her arm around me as if I were her own sweet child. And I would do the screaming, and it did clear out the room. It cleared out the house. And the people who didn't clear out just stood in the archway of the foyer aghast. Nobody knew what to do. Here's Rosemary Thornton, who's always so self-composed, so capable, so competent. I've written 9 books. Takes a lot of self-control and self-discipline to write 9 books. I've traveled all over the country giving lectures, blah blah blah. I had quite a professional name for myself, quite a bit of success in that arena, and here I am screaming like a crazy woman. Mm-hmm. By the way, not like mm-hmm. and this woman would, her arm around me, she would pat my shoulder. And she would always say, between my screams, and she was never horrified. She never ran out. Between my screams, she would say, I know you can't believe this, but there's going to be a day when this starts to get better. You're not always going to feel like you feel today. This is a bad day. But your days, there'll be a time when they start getting better. And the thing about this woman is she had a thing not unlike your own, that she had a lot of guilt from something that had happened that resulted in somebody else's death. And it took her a lot of work to get past that. And she did. And because of that, she was able to comfort me. And my horror and my screaming and my dark night of the soul did not impress her. It did not scare her off. And mm-hmm. that probably is the number one reason I wrote this book, really. When there's a lot of reasons. One, I felt compelled. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I want to be that for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I've already had a suicide widow tell me that she took multiple screenshots of my book. You know, it's on Kindle. She took multiple screenshots and took it to her therapist and said, this is what I'm dealing with. This, what she describes here, this is what I'm dealing with now. This is how I feel. So I could not, as I say in my book, if my life had gone the way all my mission statements, written goals, and you know, everything else I did, if my life had gone the way I had planned since high school, I wouldn't have a story to tell. But it mm-hmm. did not go the way I planned. And that's, right. I mean, I hear what you're saying. The only way we can really help other trauma survivors is to know what to say and what not to say. I'll share a very private story. I went to a party, and it was a lovely little soiree with, I guess, 7 people. And after the party, this woman who had been such a gracious host and so welcoming and just a perfect little evening event for all of us, she was in the kitchen cleaning things up, and I saw her out there crying. And I realized the other guests were kind of looking at her. I mean, it's hard to see a grown woman standing there just sobbing. So I got up from the table and I thought, I don't know what's going on, but I got up from the table and I said, "Hey, I see you're crying. What's going on?" And she said, "I miss my husband so much." And I said, "I understand better than most." And she said, no, you don't understand." She said, "We had an argument, and then he went outside and killed himself." And I said, I smiled and I said, "Not to one up you." mm-hmm. But I went through something very similar. And she said, "Are you serious?" And I said, and I used strong language that I won't use on this show, mm-hmm. but I said, "These blankety blanks really did a number on us, didn't they?" And I said, I get angry. I can't decide if I'm angry with him, or if I hate him, or if I love him. I said, I can never really decide, especially on days when I miss him, on special days. And the point is, I got her to laughing. And my friend, who was still at the table, was observing this. And he said, "I see you get up. I think, what is she doing? She doesn't even know this woman. She's going to go out there and comfort her." And then I look up, and 60 seconds later, she's laughing out loud. And you are too. And I realize, there's no way on this earth I could have done that if I had not had a similar experience. They would have been hollow words, hollow comforts. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I never said, "Oh, this is so bad. This is so bad." I said, you know, I said strong language about what I thought of these men. Mm-hmm. And that I just, if that, and I love, love, love. And I mentioned this earlier that you used the word ministry. That really helped me reframe the whole issue. You know, if all that suffering I went through, if that dark night of the soul that went on for 29 months in hell, 29 mm-hmm. months of living in 15-minute increments. I had another suicide widow tell me one time, "Stop trying to survive the day, survive in 15-minute increments." And mm-hmm. so if my story can help somebody understand. Necessary. Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's if that's why I went through this, to have a story to tell that brings others a blessing, mm-hmm. I guess it was the right thing. You mentioned the sacred contracts too. Sometimes I wonder if I signed up for this gig. You know, even Alexander wrote Proof of Heaven, and people say, "Oh, it's a neurologist's view of heaven. How cool. Well, I'm a sensitive soul and a writer. Maybe my view of this experience can be a blessing.
Mm-hmm. I went to a Red Thread group. I don't know if you've ever heard of those or if it's just a singular name.
Never heard of that.
And it was at a... long story. I used to attend a really conservative church and a very liberal church and then a middle of the road church. And I did it just to expose myself to as many ideas as possible. And I even joined a agnostic atheist Toastmaster group to learn to be around people that strongly believed in things that I didn't, to be at equal peace with everything that I hear and experience. And this liberal church had a red thread group, and I love the minister, and I bought one of her books too. Maybe I should interview her someday. But it was for survivors of people who had committed suicide, not as in we tried to commit suicide, but a loved one had.
Right.
And the dark night of the soul, part of that was the alcoholic that was in my life had drank herself to death after I left the relationship. You know, and I felt like God gave me a timeline, and I followed that timeline, and a little part of me wanted to feel responsible for, like, she might have lived if I would have just tried harder and stuck it out or whatever. And, you know, everyone's story is different. And in God's economy, nothing is wasted. It doesn't mean something is right or wrong. It just means it's not wasted. You know, if we choose.
Absolutely. I use that line a lot.
Yeah. Right. I'm telling you, there's more synchronicities as you were telling your story than I can begin to tell you. You know,
there is no waste in, you know, the divine economy. I use that line a lot.
And, you know, I had a vision of the 12-step program when I was 19, and it was years later before I sobered up. And I had a silver helmet on. Long story, there's just a whole bunch of stuff. And when you talked about the silver cord from your head to your feet, you know, and it was just a God vision. This wasn't just like a dream. It was a God vision. And so working by moonlight, and another story, you referred to the, you know, to that presence. I think maybe it was the Holy Spirit, and I consider the Holy Spirit to be feminine as well, and you referred to it as feminine. And working by night is where I had this dream, and, you know, the moon works by night and the sun works by day. Day is masculine and night is feminine, the, you know, the two lights. And that's the meaning of my life, is the sensitivity, the feminine sensitivity. And it's not, you know, male or female per se, it's masculine and feminine, totally different things, you know. And and then the mist, the white mist that you referred to, before I killed little Timmy, I hate to even say it that way, but I saw a vision. I was peering through this white mist, and I've been in the white mist, but it was a little different than the white mist that you were in as far as where it went. And then that mist opened and I saw a tunnel. It was slowly clearing just in the tunnel, and the white mist was everywhere else. And at the end of that opening, that conduit, I saw a naked infant with a noose around his neck hanging dead. And, you know, and then that disappeared, and then I was peering through the mist again, and then I saw, as it cleared it once again, there was this clock that read a quarter to 11. And then I woke up from that dream just questioning my own sanity, and I didn't tell anyone about that dream. You know, after about 3 days, I felt like maybe I started to like think maybe I wasn't totally insane. Why did I have this dream? Well, 3 months later, I have this incident. And then the next day I was being brought to court for an arraignment. And as we pulled up to the courthouse, there was this clock up in the steeple of the courthouse that read a quarter to 11. And when I saw it, I recognized it. And I said, oh my God, I've seen this before. You know, and when you told the doctors that you know, you're fine, you know, and they look at you like you're a nutcase. You know, and this cop says, he looked left and right, what, you know, and I said, this, I've seen this before. And I told him about the dream. He went right in and told the judge I was nuts and trying to beat the case on insanity defense, you know, and this is what the world does with this stuff. And, you know, the things that have been done in your life, the things I've done in my life, you know, how we use them is so important, you know. And I can't remember the exact point I was trying to make with that, But oh yes, I didn't understand why I had that dream. And then one day, as I'm speaking, this is after I'm in sobriety, years later, I didn't sober up over this, by the way, I wasn't that smart. And but I realized that I had that dream, not for me, but for someone else. It didn't help me, but I tell them about the dream and it helps them. So they have a warning that I couldn't heed. And they might need to hear that. It's like when you told your story and you had this healing, I was going, oh my God, you know, if she can heal from that, what can happen in my life? Maybe I can heal. And then, you know, you're alive for the same reason I'm alive. And, you know, I would have committed suicide had it not been up to God if I live or die. But secondly, I also knew that if I didn't go through it, if somebody else was struggling the way I was during the dark night and they were suicidal and needed some help, if I'm dead, I couldn't help them. And yeah. I needed to stay for them. So, you know, that was my nurse sitting on the stool, sobbing, and you're feeling her heart, you know, and the Holy Spirit is in my chest and tells me this is true. You know, and the day I was loving God so desperately, just pure love, the room turned dark. And it was like that dark black velvet you referred to. And the Holy Spirit, you know, it's like the room became dark right when I'm loving. It's like, what's this? I can see nothing. And then the Spirit appeared before me and it came into my body. And then I could see again. And that Spirit has been there ever since, you know. And it didn't have, I was actually in prison for this crime of killing this baby. I pled guilty to manslaughter. And the Holy Spirit didn't have to get on my visiting list, you know, and I realized there's no prison wall so thick that God can't get through it. And, you know, we all have our own prisons, and a lot of people think that my prison is different than their prison, but they're all the same. Prison's prison. And the prison of our mind is always more secure, the one we build for ourselves, than anything else anyone can build for us. And you can be as happy as you make up your mind to be, even there, no matter where it is. It might take years, and it might not, you know.
Or it might take a lifetime, and it might never happen.
It might not ever happen.
Suffering is not doled out in equal measure in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who collapse under the weight of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's true.
You know, they go insane, or they kill themselves, or yes. they make poor choices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are, I that thing that, and I heard it too many times, God doesn't give us more than we can handle.
Yes,
I actually
does.
Had a minister
Always.
Say, yes, I had a minister said, absolutely, God gives you more than you can handle, because only then can you turn to God. And if you find your freedom and peace, you can say, I didn't do that. That was God's hand mm-hmm. in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's true. And, you know, seriously, if my life had gone the way I planned, I would not have a story to tell. And I put in my book, in the front page of my book, I have SDG, which I don't know if you're, are you familiar with SDG?
No.
Handel, and I think it was Bach, might have been that page. But Handel put it on every piece of music he ever composed, ever. And it's Soli Deo Gloria, which means all to the glory of God. And he did that because he said, this music, this composition is for God. And if I get that right, by extension, it's naturally going to be a blessing to all of God's children.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wrote this book, and I have obstacles, and I stumbled and I struggled. And the first iterations of this book, you could still see how angry I was about the mess, you know, that this had mm-hmm. come into my life. But the SDG was kind of a guiding light for me, that if I write this book only to glorify God, if God is my audience, then I'm mm-hmm. not going to have an angry story. I'm not going to be full of acrimony and vitriol. So SDG is a big thing, and it was my own guiding light. Solo Deo Gloria, to God alone all glory.
There was a woman who I used to speak with a lot in MAD, and she had lost her son as well, different woman. And we got done speaking at a prison. minimum security. And afterwards, I told her, I said, well, your grief is so much worse than mine because you lost your son and you loved your son and you knew him. I killed somebody's son. I didn't know him. So my grief couldn't compare to yours. And she said something that you just said in so many words. She said, grief ain't a contest. And I thought that was really profound. And she took the hook that had been in there and removed it, you know, one of the hooks. And I really hope I didn't come across as saying that when somebody capitulates or is traumatized and they give up, that somehow they're defined by that and they had a way out. There's no judgment there. They're not defined by, I'm not defined by the worst things I've done anymore, and I'm defined by the best things I've done. It's not about me. And a friend of mine's son or daughter killed herself, and she's pointed out that, you know, her daughter was a wonderful human being, and she's not defined by her suicide, just like the woman that was in my life. I loved her more than myself, but not more than God. And when she was gone, that was very difficult. But what led up to it was even more difficult. But I don't judge her for giving up or whatever it was, you know. And there's just, I don't know, you know. I guess.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah. I try not to wander. I get a lot of hypothetical questions like, is your husband alive in an alternate universe? And, you know, is there anything you could have done to stop this? And on, you know. And I stay out of the hypotheticals.
Yeah.
Because my trauma is unique to me. I don't know what it's like to lose a child. I don't know what it's like to be in your position. And when you get in, it's especially dangerous for those people I call normies, people who haven't had a severe trauma in their life. When you get into talking about possibilities and theoreticals and hypotheticals, especially as it relates to suffering and God's grace, boy, I think that's dangerous territory. You know, and that's the thing with my book. One of the things I struggled with is, what is my message? And I thought, really, your message is just to tell the story that you were on a path straight to hell. And God intervened and said, look, go back. It's going to get better. So it's just a story. I mean, let me restate that. It's my story. Mm-hmm. It's not, here's what will work for you. It's not a formula. It's not a science. It's not some mathematical thing that can be, I hope it can be reproduced by leaning on God, but it's just my story. And once I saw that, that helped me find my audience, which is God, and it also helped me write it. But I'm not a therapist. I'm not a trained apologetic. You know, I'm just a chick who likes to read and has had this interesting experience. But yeah, I get real nervous. I was on a panel discussion, and there were people there talking way beyond their pay grade, as we say. And they were saying things about, oh, if you lose a child, you just need to learn how to connect with him as he's in heaven and just chat with him like you chat with him. He's in the room, and that will help you heal. And I thought, you know what? You need to shut up. I guess if I had more nerve, I would have just said that. But yeah, that whole thing makes me really nervous. You never know where somebody is in their experience and what they're struggling with and what's their background. You know, if you've had a great life and, you know, you had a mom and a dad that loved you and you just had things go well and then you get hit with a sidewinder like this, you know, maybe you can use your own coping skills and figure out, you know, how to manage this. But if you've just had trauma after trauma after trauma, and then you get hit with one when you're in your 30s, 40s, or 50s, man, that can slam your face right into the dirt. And I did meet one woman that she was out with her husband. They were in a car. They had the two kids in the back seat. Husband fell asleep at the wheel. Her whole family was killed in one car accident. Mm-hmm. She was a lone survivor. It took her 25 years to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And she's still... I mean, she'll never be the same person she was before that happened. Mm-hmm. So I just, again, what is time? You know, what does time really mean? And, you know, not to get too deep, but I really do, you know, my favorite story briefly, this is my favorite story in the whole world. There's a story, and I believe it's accurate, that St. John was the disciple that lived the longest. After all the other disciples had died or been killed, Jesus's disciples didn't all have good endings. think it was Peter that ended up crucified upside down on a cross. So St. John was the one, I think that was, he was the one they tried to boil in oil, and the oil eventually boiled away, and they're like, well, that was disappointing. He's still alive. We gave that one our best shot. Anyway, Fox's Book of Martyrs, don't read it unless you have a strong stomach. So St. John, he's an old man. He's, you know, laying in his hut somewhere, and people come to him and say, what was it like to walk with Jesus? What was it like to be a student of the Messiah, of Jesus Christ? What was it like? And he was plagued with this again and again, and he always gave them the same five-word answer. Have you ever heard this? That what St. John would tell people? I love this so much. No matter how many times they bored into him and drilled him for an answer about what it was like to walk the earth with Jesus Christ, he always said, little children, love one another. And I think that's it. You know, and rather than talk about the multi dimensions where my husband's still alive or where a child didn't die or whatever, I think we just need to back up and say, little children, love one another.
Amen. Yeah. If it ain't about love, it ain't about God. Be as little children. Yeah, I get that. I like that. I hope I can compartmentalize it in the same way. What would you like to leave the audience with, Rose?
I guess the most important thing, well, there's a lot of important things. I guess one of the important things is, if you've ever had, you know, and again, for your audience, if anyone's ever had a thought about ending their own life, understand it doesn't stop the pain. It just transfers it to someone else and multiplies it exponentially. Mm-hmm. The amount of pain that my husband's suicide inflicted on people, unbelievable. And it nearly killed me. It's something that I don't think I've ever shared this publicly, but I'll share with you and, you know, however many listeners you have. Shortly after this, I had a psychotic break. I just couldn't function, couldn't eat, blah, blah, blah. And so I got bad news after bad news, friends dropping after friends dropping. A friend said something especially unkind, and this was about 6 weeks in. So I'm not in my right mind. I am definitely not in my right mind. So I go to my house where this had happened, which I didn't spend much time there. I only went there to get stuff. But I went to my house, and I pulled my four-cylinder Camry into the garage, and I shut the door behind me. And I keep a notepad in the car, and I pulled out my notepad, and I wrote a very beautiful note. And I left the car on. I figured carbon monoxide, go to sleep at the end. So while I'm waiting for the carbon monoxide to fill my 400 square foot garage, I'm writing out this really lovely note. And it says, this is not your fault. You know, whoever reads this, please tell everybody, this is my choice, my decision. When you put enough weights on somebody's back, eventually you can put that last set of 20 pounds on their back and their knees will buckle. It is inevitable. So to say that you're not being strong enough, I say BS. So that's, and I wrote this note, I'm writing, I'm thinking, I'm not getting sleepy. Why isn't this working?
I made the decision. I think I get it. Yeah.
Oh my God. I am like, are you kidding? I can't even off myself. I finally make the decision. I have this beautiful note that goes on for pages and pages. Well, the bottom line is, it was a Camry hybrid. It was the one with the Synergy in it. And it kept cutting off. And one, the hybrids by design burn, I don't know, multiple times cleaner than a traditional gas engine. And secondly, it kept cutting off because that's how hybrids work, to conserve energy, and they go to electric. So I'm waiting and I'm waiting. And I think, all right, I know how to solve this. It has a 32 cell nickel metal hydride battery in the backseat, you know, under the backseat. I'll run all the accessories, drain that battery, and then the engine will stay on. So I turn on the seat heater. I turn on the radio, I turn on the AC, and I open the sunroof over and over again. I'm doing everything I can to keep this engine going, and I'm not getting sleepy. And I realize I will starve to death before this car and its fumes take me out. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me?
Very strange Weight Watchers commercial.
Oh my God. I've seen commercials that are, yes. I thought, okay, this didn't work. It should have, but it didn't. And then I thought, well, I'll go borrow a car and I'll bring a V6 in here. That'll do the trick. You know? And then by the time I opened the garage, I thought, you can write all the words you want and this will ruin your three children's lives. No matter what words you put on paper, they will never be the same. Nothing will ever be the same. All these people who tried so hard to help you, you will ruin their lives too. And that was, and I don't mean to make light of it, but that's where I was. A woman that knows that God is real and heaven is a place and consequences have actions. I just couldn't take the pain another minute. And once I walked out of that garage, I think I went and told a friend what I had done, and I shredded the suicide note. But it's you just don't know. You don't know how hard it is to just keep, as you said, it's very true, 15 seconds at a time. Take a deep breath. Go look at a flower. But get through it. Sometimes you just got to get through these things seconds at a time and hope that one day it'll turn around. But yes, that would be my message, is no matter how bad your life looks, don't end it. I really do believe that ultimately, I believe if you end your own life, you still have to learn those lessons. I don't know what the math is. I don't know what it looks like.
Right.
But yeah. I think sometimes we just have to face some very hard life lessons and put our heads down and find a way to keep pushing on. And in my case, I really do believe that suicide just multiplies the pain and puts it on somebody else.
Yes, it does. That's partly why I didn't leave either. Yeah. I love you, sister. I appreciate your work in this world. And I just hope people's hearts are unbruised when they come into contact with your life story and the message that you've been sent to carry. And, on breaking a heart to some extent, maybe. I'm not sure what words to put at this, but you made my life better. I'll just personalize it. Your story helped me. And this morning I was walking around smiling and kind of almost kicking my heels together and feeling that gratitude, you know. And I think, you know, that's what I needed today. And I'll keep passing this on. Thank you for being on the Incomplete Skeptic. And if there's anything I can do to help you, just let me know. I'll make sure people know about your website. And I'll share it on my media to the best of my ability and give you a copy of the show and stuff like that. Sound great?
That would be great. I will include it on my social media as well.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Rosemary. Peace out.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.